Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, a private markets edition for this Friday, June 12th, 2026.
Today, we are examining the widening divergence between capital deployment and risk appetite. While the prevailing assumption was that liquidity would normalize following the recent interest rate adjustments, we are instead seeing a structural tightening in the underlying credit architecture.
So the expected rebound is actually hitting a wall.
Precisely.
We begin by navigating the private credit crunch and the specific pressures mounting across the mid-market lending landscape. Blackstone's BCRED just hit a massive wall, with withdrawal requests climbing to $4.4 billion in the second quarter, that's 10% of the fund's holdings. Welcome to the Private Markets Edition. Today we are navigating the private credit crunch.
It's a significant signal of liquidity strain, Maya, and it's not isolated to Blackstone. We're seeing similar redemption pressures across the board, with Blue Owl, Ares, and Partners Group all facing elevated outflows.
And when elevated outflows happens, the industry suddenly remembers how to use the word gating, which is just a polite way of saying you can look at the assets, but you can't touch your money.
There's a signal here, it's a structural defense. Blue Owl, for instance, has already implemented caps on withdrawals for certain vehicles to manage the mismatch between the illiquid nature of mid-market loans and the high liquidity demands of wealth-linked investors.
So we have a situation where the private in private credit is becoming a literal physical barrier between the investor and their cash. Is this a systemic insolvency problem, or just a case of people panicking because they can't exit a revolving door?
The data suggests it's more of a localized liquidity event. At Ares, for example, the recent 11% withdrawal volume was concentrated among small-scale institutions, family offices, and non-US clients, affecting fewer than 5% of their total investor base.
Okay, so the big institutional players are still sitting pretty, but the retail and wealth management crowd is getting twitchy. Why the sudden bout of sector-specific anxiety?
It's a pincer movement of three specific threats. First, there is a massive asset liability mismatch in interval funds. Second, we have an overleveraged vintage of 2021 and 2022 LBOs approaching a maturity wall in 2027 and 2028. And third, there is extreme exposure to a very specific, very vulnerable sector, software.
Ah, the software sector. I assume this has something to do with the fact that every company is currently trying to replace their workforce with an LLM.
The Credit Edge by Bloomberg Intelligence reported that roughly 50% of the $1.5 trillion leveraged finance direct lending market carries significant AI-related risk. Scott Goodwin argues that if you use LLMs to audit individual loans, you see that half the sector, SaaS, IT services, and healthcare IT, is fundamentally vulnerable to AI-driven disruption.
So lenders are essentially providing capital to companies whose entire business model might be automated out of existence by next Tuesday. And yet these software loans are trading near par, right?
That's the danger. Because these loans trade at 98 or 99 cents, there's very little recovery potential. If AI displacement happens, the equity-like risk isn't being priced into the debt. We're already seeing bad PIK emerge, where borrowers are unilaterally shifting from cash interest to payment in kind to manage liquidity.
Payment in kind. For the uninitiated, that's just I'll pay you back with more debt later because I can't afford the cash today. It's the financial equivalent of promising to pay for dinner with a different promise to pay for dessert.
It's a signal of breakdown in the original credit terms. This is compounded by what some are calling Swiss cheese documentation. As Brooke Hinchel noted, modern debt documents are losing traditional covenants and gaining baskets that allow lenders to create new super senior layers of debt, which complicates the entire capital structure.
It sounds like the legal protections are thinning out just as the underlying assets are getting riskier. And now we have the insurance companies entering the fray, adding a whole new layer of complexity.
The integration of insurance capital is massive. Privately rated bonds grew from 1.5% of insurer portfolios in 2018 to over 12% by 2025. Columbia Business School study flagged that this $481 billion exposure to managers like Blackstone, Apollo, and KKR might be understated because private letter ratings can appear 2 to 3 notches higher than public benchmarks.
Which creates a lovely little capital arbitrage loop. Insurers use these opaque, inflated ratings to reduce their regulatory capital charges, essentially buying the illusion of safety.
It's a structural shift in asset liability management. However, KBRA has pushed back, arguing that the projected drop in the industry's aggregate risk-based capital ratio is functionally negligible. They argue the Columbia study is based on a modeled sensitivity, an arbitrary two-notch adjustment, rather than an empirical deficit.
But even if the capital ratio holds, there's the forced selling ghost in the machine.
That's the real systemic fear. As the Credit Edge by Bloomberg Intelligence points out, the threat isn't widespread economic default, but rather a downgrade-driven liquidation. If BBB-rated tranches are downgraded, insurance companies might be forced to sell for regulatory reasons, potentially mirroring the 2023 banking crisis seen in the CMBS market.
So it's not about whether the companies can pay their debts, but whether the people holding the debt are legally allowed to keep it. It's a house of cards, but the cards are all made of highly rated, very expensive paper.
It's certainly a period of maturation. We've seen direct lending issuance drop significantly in the quarter ending May 2026, driven by competition from the more attractively priced syndicated loan market. The era of easy, unscrutinized expansion is cooling.
Investors need to stop buying yesterday's portfolio and start looking at the 2023 and 2024 vintages with much more skepticism.
The focus is shifting from chasing yield to managing the structural mismatch.
Regulators will need to move past looking at aggregate ratios and start auditing the actual methodology of these private rating agencies.
All eyes will be on the 2027 maturity wall to see if those software-heavy vintages can actually refinance, or if the Swiss cheese documents finally fail them.
But if the credit markets are bracing for a squeeze, it's no surprise that the massive capital expenditures required for the next generation of computing are facing their own set of economic hurdles. If you had told me a few years ago that the biggest way to play the AI boom wasn't by betting on chatbots, but by betting on high-voltage transformers and liquid cooling pipes, I would have asked you to check your pulse. Are we actually witnessing the transformation of the most advanced software revolution into a massive, heavy metal construction project?
It's not just an analogy, Maya. It's the fundamental reality of the capital flows we're seeing right now. We are moving out of the era of chip shortages and into the era of power and shell constraints. The bottleneck has shifted from how many GPUs you can buy to whether you can find a data center shell that is actually energized and cooled.
It's less about the brains of the operation and more about the plumbing.
The implication runs deeper. The industry is undergoing what Invest Like the Best calls a decommoditization of hardware. We're moving away from low-margin, interchangeable parts toward high IP, specialized assets. Because AI workloads push hardware to physical limits, we're seeing an unprecedented surge in demand for things like 40-layer PCBs and complex liquid cooling systems. You can see this in the markets. Look at Inneo, which saw its order intake for data center equipment explode from $27 million just 2 years ago to $2.28 billion in 2025.
Okay, so the money is flowing into the physical backbone. But this sounds incredibly expensive. I keep seeing these massive multi-billion dollar numbers that look more like sovereign wealth fund budgets than tech startup rounds.
That's because we've entered a period of massive, structured private market financing. Take the Broadcom-led XBV platform, for example. We're seeing a $35 billion capital solution involving Apollo Global Management, Blackstone, and a syndicate of global banks. The goal is to support over 20 GW of compute capacity through 2028. This isn't just a loan. It's a new, integrated model that links hardware, networking, and long-term capital to meet the needs of frontier labs.
And I'm assuming Anthropic is one of the ones waiting at the end of that much money.
A significant portion of these funds is earmarked to support Anthropic's expansion of more than 1 GW of compute infrastructure for training and inference, starting here in mid-2026. But the way they are funding it is the real story for the private markets. They are using a three-tranche special-purpose vehicle structure to acquire and lease advanced chips directly to the labs. As Oddlots noted, this asset co-financing via SPVs allows providers like CoreWeave to pair long-term, take-or-pay client contracts with debt amortization schedules. It effectively turns a highly speculative hardware deployment into a predictable, investment-grade credit instrument.
Wait, let me decode that for the rest of us. You're saying they figured out how to take the massive, unpredictable risk of an AI lab failing and hide it inside a structured debt product that looks like a boring utility bond.
That is exactly the mechanism. Private Equity Insights pointed out that Broadcom's use of residual value support agreements effectively decouples the credit risk of the hardware from the operational risk of the AI labs. This allows the debt to trade in line with the chipmaker's corporate credit profile rather than the extreme volatility of the AI sector. It's a way to commoditize compute capacity using the massive balance sheets of firms like Apollo and Blackstone.
It sounds like a closed loop. The chipmakers provide the hardware, the private equity firms provide the specialized debt, and the AI labs provide the take-or-pay contracts. But does this loop actually produce any profit, or are we just building an incredibly expensive high-tech engine that burns cash?
That is the trillion-dollar question. There is a massive capital-to-revenue imbalance emerging. Some analysts, like Rajiv Jain at GQG Partners, are incredibly skeptical, noting that the projected $3 trillion in infrastructure spending isn't being matched by proportional revenue growth. He points out that the Magnificent Seven are shifting from capital-light, high-margin businesses to these capital-intensive models, which is actively eroding their free cash flow.
And if the revenue doesn't show up, the whole thing becomes a very expensive pile of silicon.
Or worse, it creates a zero-margin equilibrium. Adlotz highlighted that as every major quantitative trading firm pours massive capex into the same AI technology stack, the competitive advantage of any single firm is competed away by the rising cost of the infrastructure itself. We're seeing the technology become a commodity, but the cost of the commodity is skyrocketing.
It feels like we're building a massive high-stakes power grid where the users are all fighting for the same socket. And then you add in the fact that these data centers need water and land, and suddenly you've got a resource collision with local farmers and utilities.
We are already seeing the friction. There's a real tension in the PJM interconnection region, where capacity costs surged by nearly 400% in the first quarter of 2026. There's also a looming conflict in drought-stricken western states, where the water intensity of these massive AI clusters is starting to compete directly with agricultural needs.
So the arms race isn't just about who has the best algorithm, it's about who can secure the most megawatts and the most gallons of water before the regulators step in.
The data tells a story. The winners will be the ones who can navigate the physical and political constraints, whether that's through specialized hardware like liquid cooling or through energy autonomy, like the move towards small modular reactors to bypass the decade-long grid connection delays.
Investors in the power supply chain need to watch for any shift in regulatory mandates regarding on-site energy generation.
The real signal to watch is the quarterly dividend or cash flow guidance from the hyperscalers. If the CapEx doesn't start yielding a higher return on capital, the whole credit structure for these SPVs could face a massive reality check.
But all of this massive debt-fueled building is happening while a different kind of pressure is mounting in the portfolios of the world's largest buyout shops. I was looking at my portfolio this morning and realized that even my set and forget index funds feel like they're stuck in a permanent waiting room. It feels like nothing in the markets actually moves lately. Everything just sits there, accruing fees and waiting for permission to exit.
That's actually a pretty accurate way to describe the current state of private equity. We're seeing what analysts are calling a massive exit backlog, where an estimated $4 trillion in unsold assets is essentially trapped in a holding pattern.
$4 trillion just sitting there. That sounds like a recipe for a very expensive, very stagnant era of stagnant growth, rising management fees, and a sudden panicked rush to sell everything at a discount.
It's more structural than a simple panic. The fundamental issue is a widening gap between what sellers want and what buyers will pay. As Imkitchen reported, the industry is grappling with an overhang of assets from the 2020 to 2022 era, a period defined by extremely low interest rates and aggressive capital deployment. Now that we've transitioned into a higher rate environment, those high entry multiples are simply much harder to justify.
So the buy low, sell high mantra has been replaced by buy high and pray the market recovers before the fund expires.
Because traditional exits like IPOs and trade sales have been underwhelming, the entire circulatory system of the industry is essentially experiencing functional breakdown. According to data from exchanges, the 500 basis point hike by the Fed increased debt costs, but private portfolios were slow to mark down their valuations. This created a massive indigestion where distributions to investors have plummeted from a 20% average to roughly 8 to 10%.
I love the term indigestion. It makes it sound like the market just had won too many overpriced tech acquisitions, and now it's regretting everything.
It's more of a metabolic slowdown. We're seeing average buyout holding periods climb to 6 or 7 years, nearly doubling the historical norm of 3 to 4. Even in venture capital, the time to IPO has stretched from 5.5 years to 14 years. This creates a massive bottleneck where GPs, the general partners, can't distribute cash to LPs, which means LPs can't redeploy that capital into new opportunities.
Which means the liquidity premium everyone talks about is starting to look less like a reward and potentially more like a penalty for being unable to get your money out.
That's a sharp point. In fact, How I Invest with David Weisbord noted that this liquidity premium is currently highly volatile and trading at over 5%, significantly above its 30-year average of 3.5%. The risk isn't just the delay, it's the uncertainty of the return.
So if you can't use the front door, the IPO, or the side door, the trade sale, what's left? Are we just watching GPs renovate the same houses indefinitely?
They're looking for much more complex exits. We are seeing a structural pivot towards secondary transactions and continuation vehicles to bypass the traditional route. There's an increasing reliance on the secondary market to move these legacy assets. Even the potential $6 billion sale of Gen II, backed by HG, is being watched as a critical barometer for whether the industry can actually generate liquidity events in this climate.
But isn't there a limit to how many workaround exits you can have before LPs start looking under the hood and realizing the engine isn't actually running?
There is significant skepticism. LPs are scrutinizing continuation vehicles much more closely now. And there's a darker side to the mechanics, too. Credited investor insights pointed out that certain tools, like subscription lines and NAV-based financing, can create a psychologically powerful but economically modest illusion of performance by manipulating cash flow timing to artificially inflate IRR without actually improving the underlying asset value.
So it's essentially sophisticated accounting used to mask the fact that the exit is stuck in traffic.
It's even moving into the realm of securitization. Look at Blackstone exploring a $2 billion plus collateralized fund obligation, or CFO. This is a strategic shift toward using securitization as a capital recycling tool to manage those 2020-2022 era portfolios without the GP having to relinquish long-term exposure to the assets. If this trend scales, we could see near-term issuances exceeding $30 billion.
It feels like the industry is building a complex series of plumbing repairs to keep the water moving, even if the water itself is stagnant.
The scale of the potential secondary shock is enormous. AcroVoices highlighted that the real risk to the equity market isn't necessarily the upcoming $250 billion in massive IPOs from players like SpaceX or OpenAI. It's the $3 trillion overhang of restricted shares from PE founders and VCs that is set to unlock by the end of 2027. When that much supply hits the market, it could trigger a massive drawdown.
It's a massive amount of unlocked pressure waiting to hit the valves.
Stepping back, we're already seeing the localized effects. Private Equity Wire reported that the 3% drop in Partners Group shares, hitting their weakest level since April 2020, illustrates how a single liquidity management failure, like redemption caps on an $8.6 billion fund, can trigger a systemic reevaluation of risk across the entire listed private market sector.
Limited partners need to start auditing their GP's exit timelines with much more rigor.
The next big signal will be whether we see a significant spike in the volume of continuation vehicle transactions involving 2021-era assets, which will tell us if this is a temporary bottleneck or a permanent shift in the private equity lifecycle.
It makes you wonder if this entire cycle of heavy spending is finally meeting its match in the reality of much tighter margins. But shifting from the macro plumbing of private equity, let's look at how the way people actually buy and sell everyday products is undergoing its own quiet revolution.
Maya, I've been looking at the recent L. Catterton backing of Remedy, and it feels like we're witnessing a fundamental rewiring of how consumer brands are built and valued.
Rewiring? That sounds a bit dramatic, Alex. Are we talking about a structural shift, or did someone just find a better way to use TikTok Shop?
It's much more than a distribution trick. We're seeing the rise of the clinician educator. As Private Equity Insights noted, people like Dr. Muneeb Shah are leveraging massive clinical authority. He has 20 million followers to bypass the traditional, expensive brand-building hurdles. It's a direct line from clinical expertise to consumer trust, which creates a massive moat for new, science-backed players to disrupt incumbents.
Instead of a billion-dollar Super Bowl ad, you just need a dermatologist with a ring light and a high-functioning skincare formula.
So here's the picture: that science-led, patient-centric approach is moving from niche to mass. It's the same logic behind the expansion of the snacking tomato market. As we've seen, social media trends are driving demand for visually striking high-flavor varieties that eventually move from Instagram feeds into traditional retail.
It sounds like a lot of influencer magic, but I suspect there's a way to turn that magic into a balance sheet.
That is precisely where the institutional capital is moving. Look at the launch of Compound Creative Holdings. TPG and CAA are committing $250 million to move beyond simple revenue-sharing models. According to Private Equity Insights, they are targeting creators who have already transitioned into media entrepreneurs with tens of millions in annual sales, essentially treating these creator-led businesses as scalable, institutional-grade holding companies.
So we're moving from influencer as talent to influencer as a mini Disney studio. It's a bit much, isn't it? I can almost see the tiny, personalized Hollywood lot in a Substack newsletter.
It's a logical progression of the capital structure. There's a massive gap for specialized, equity-based growth capital for these creators. But we have to be careful with the valuations. As the Private Equity Podcast highlighted, these high-growth consumer ventures are uniquely vulnerable to overcapitalization because they can't just burn their way to an exit. They require extreme capital efficiency and organic, grassroots momentum to avoid the kind of valuation collapses we saw with companies like Allbirds.
Right, because you can't just spend your way into being a cultural icon if the product doesn't actually work.
Two things stand out. The real value is in layering. You need the functional utility, like a good hand sanitizer, but you also need the symbolic value, like how Touchland turned a commodity into a fashion accessory. We're seeing this in everything from the rise of subscription-based healthcare appliances in Korea, like the Chung Ho Group deal, to the way AI-enabled transparency is allowing clean brands to aggressively target the neurotoxins in legacy products.
It's a high bar. You need the science, the social signal, and the supply chain efficiency.
And you need to navigate a very bifurcated economy. AcroVoices has pointed out a profound divergence where the bottom 60% of consumers are feeling significant economic pain. Look at the recent drops in McDonald's or Home Depot stocks, while the wealthy are sustaining much of the consumption through high-yielding money market funds.
So the opportunity isn't just in finding the next big trend, but in identifying which layer of the consumer base actually has the liquidity to sustain it.
We can trace that further. Whether it's the premiumization of skincare or the institutionalization of the creator economy, the winners are those who can bridge the gap between clinical or digital authority and mass market scalability.
Private equity firms should start looking for those clinician educators who can scale beyond the screen. Just watch for any sudden drop in those snacking tomato margins, because that will tell you if the consumer's appetite for premium trends is finally hitting a ceiling. But if the big players are moving into these niche spaces, does that mean the era of the independent, cult-favorite brand is being swallowed by institutional giants? I'm convinced that democratizing private markets is just a polite euphemism for engineering away everything that makes the asset class actually work.
That's a heavy way to start, Maya, but if you're talking about the push toward retail access in private equity, you're touching on the core tension in the industry right now.
I'm serious, Alex. We're taking an asset class built on decades of wait and see and trying to turn it into a high-frequency TikTok scroll. Is this actually about access or just about finding new people to buy the leftovers?
Well, accredited investor insights suggest your skepticism has merit. They argue that retail democratization often functions as a structural redesign rather than true access, where the fundamental mechanics, illiquidity, and patient capital are essentially engineered out to facilitate distribution.
The pattern is clear. You can't just strip the long-term out of long-term investing and call it a feature.
The mechanism is usually the move toward evergreen, open-ended structures. The problem, as Leila Kunimoto points out, is that these create a dangerous duration mismatch. You're attempting to manufacture liquidity from fundamentally illiquid underlying assets, which stays invisible during benign markets, but triggers massive gates in forced asset sales the moment redemption requests spike during a downturn.
We're basically building a dam out of wet sand and acting surprised when it washes away during a storm.
It gets more complex when you look at the performance metrics. Kunimoto warns that techniques like NAV-based financing and subscription lines can create a psychologically powerful but economically modest illusion of performance, effectively inflating IRR by manipulating cash flow timing without actually improving the underlying asset value.
Wait, so you're telling me the great returns everyone is seeing might just be clever accounting involving delayed capital calls?
It's a telling detail. And it's not just the metrics, it's the plumbing. While some are looking at self-clearing platforms like Altruist to reduce friction and lower investment minimums, with Jason Wink noting that pre-IPO access could materialize as early as later this summer, the software-only approach has limits. Modern Capital argues that the efficiency of private markets is ultimately capped by legacy infrastructure. You can't truly slash costs without rebuilding the underlying custodial plumbing.
It's a bit much, isn't it? We're discussing the structural disintegration of an entire asset class's DNA, and I'm sitting here in a studio eating a granola bar.
It is high stakes. We're seeing a push for omnibus accounts to fix settlement drift, but the real risk is the conflict of interest in the private banking model. If advisors are compensated by the funds they sell rather than the clients they serve, access becomes a transfer of value rather than wealth creation.
Which is why the real winners will be the ones who demand the same economic terms as the institutions.
Exactly, the focus has to shift from liquidity to alignment, matching specific investor profiles to the right vehicles, rather than forcing everyone into a liquid model that doesn't fit the assets.
Wealth managers need to stop selling liquidity and start selling transparency, specifically around revenue and profitability at the company level. Watch for a spike in redemption requests in the major evergreen vehicles during the next market volatility spike to see if those mismatches finally break. As we wrap up this edition, the throughline is clear. We are witnessing a fundamental decoupling of capital from liquidity. Whether it is the structural mismatch in private credit, the heavy metal capital expenditures required for AI, or the mounting backlog of unliquidated private equity, the common denominator is a massive accumulation of stuck value that is increasingly reliant on complex debt-backed engineering to maintain the appearance of momentum.
Worth noting, the most critical implication here isn't just about market volatility. It's about a fundamental shift in the mandate for the chief investment officer at major insurance firms. For years, the strategy was simple: capture the yield spread of privately rated bonds. But as that exposure has ballooned from 1.5% to over 12%, the CIO's calculus is moving from yield optimization to systemic solvency. They are no longer just managing a portfolio. They are managing a massive, concentrated exposure to the very infrastructure and credit cycles that are currently experiencing a metabolic slowdown. If the underlying assets, the AI power grids, or the mid-market debt hit a structural snag, the insurer isn't just losing a dividend. They are facing a direct hit to their regulatory capital.
The focus moves from chasing the spread to guarding the gate.
Something to flag here, if you want to know if this structural tension is about to break, watch the upcoming Q3 credit rating reports for the large-scale privately rated bond issuances held by the major insurance players. A single downward revision in the credit quality of these A-linked infrastructure vehicles would be the signal that the liquidity premium we are seeing is actually a massive, unpriced risk premium finally being priced in.
That will certainly be the moment to watch. Thanks for joining us this Friday. We'll see you next week.